have one moth flowing from right to left on the auxiliary line. If I didn't properly terminate that one watt running from right to left on the auxiliary line, then the reflection coefficient I would get there would bounce back on the auxiliary line from left to right as a reflection, and it would appear as though the directivity had degraded. So you got to have proper termination on both sides, if I remember correctly, in order to both see the direction, directivity, and to make sure it doesn't get confused by the visual you've created by improper termination. You got to terminate both sides. So your rectifier on one side, I think if you're a purist, really should be a rectifier with diode across that terminating resistor, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Howard.
So experimentally, I would hook up a generator intermittently to each side of the main cable, and when I get the maximum ratio in my sensing line for directionality, I know I've hit the magic resistor value.
I'm pretty sure that's correct, but the next step to avoid some of the experimentation and goes right straight to home plate on the answer is nowadays, if you're an AROL member, you're allowed to look up all past articles that QST Magazine has ever had. So you sign in with your membership and you look up MonoMatch. I'm not sure how it's spelled, but this MonoMatch was an article probably 30 years ago in which you literally push back the braid on a piece of RGA cable, snaked a piece of enameled wire under the braid for a few inches, brought out the two ends of that enameled wire where it comes back out of the braid, properly terminate it and put rectifying diodes on it, and you've got a beautiful directional coupler which is being used as either a power monitor or a standing wave ratio bridge. That MonoMatch is a very simple circuit, very effective, and it does everything you and I are talking about. When you read that article on the MonoMatch or MoneyMatch, however it's spelled, I think you're going to have a lot more of the information you're looking for. Back to you, Howard.
Very good, Dick. And does that, of course, we're talking about the counter-directional coupler right now. Does the principle work pretty much in the same way of adjusting the resistors when I have a two parallel transmission lines and they loop from one to another as on strip lines?
Okay. When you say two parallel transmission lines, okay, if you're building a directional coupler in strip line or microstrip, the majority of us will design it in such a way that each of the lines are 50 ohms. Doesn't have to be. And you could, if you want to, literally take your strip line structure, which already has a main line of 50 ohms, pick up a piece of enameled wire, lay it in the vicinity of the main strip line transmission line, with a carefully chosen spacing. Just take a piece of enameled wire and lay it in there and properly terminate it, you will get a directional coupler. You will be able to adjust it for anything from a 60 dB coupling coefficient to a 60 dB coupling coefficient just by adjusting the distance. And then as you adjust the terminating resistor on your added piece of enameled wire on your strip line, the right terminating resistors will eventually give you the directivity. In that case, when you lay down that piece of enameled wire, I will admit it's not going to be a 50 ohm line, but it doesn't have to be. When you're designing it by laying down the strip lines by the real etching process, yes, we normally do it with the right Z odd and Z even, and everything is 50 ohms. But for a simple experiment of sampling power in a directional manner to an already existing strip line, you don't have that restriction. It doesn't have to be that restriction to work well. Ain't that magic? Over to you, Howard.
However, it sounded from the beginning of the discussion that most or many of the directional couplers were not counter-directional, but were made up of two strip lines that were not the proper distance. But I imagine that whichever one is used for sensing would also possibly have to be properly terminated, although not necessarily at 50 ohms if you had instrumentation right on the spot.
Yeah, let me correct something here, Howard. I may have created a confusion. When you've got a TEM structure, transverse electromagnetic structure, that really means coaxial cable or strip line or microstrip. Those are TEM structures. All TEM structure couplers are counter-directional. Only when you use waveguide, which is not TEM, it's either TE or TM, waveguide structures tend to be, as couplers, co-directional. But all TEM, coaxial or strip line-like structures, in the coupling coefficient, they are counter-directional when you properly adjusted them for directivity. You can't force it to be co-directional. It is naturally counter-directional. That's just the way Mother Nature works in the way she couples the polarity of the capacitive effect and the magnetic effect. She will add those two effects together in the counter-directional direction. She will cancel those two effects in the co-direction. I wonder if that makes some sense, Howard. Go ahead.
Yes, Dick. Yes, Dick. Definitely that makes sense. I cleared it up. I didn't understand that the co-directionality was only when you entered essentially into, really it's three-dimensional, it's like in a waveguide, as opposed to one of the really flat structures.
Okay, now, the method of transmission of a signal in a TEM structure, TEM is microstrip, strip line, coax cable, where there's a real center conductor and an outer conductor. That's a TEM structure. Any coupler you build in that structure becomes counter-directional in the coupled line. Waveguide has no center conductor. Waveguide is a TE structure, transverse electric, or transverse magnetic, TM structure. And if you really study what's going on, the signal that flows down the waveguide does not go straight down the line, down the guide, like your eyesight does. At the frequency where the waveguide is properly operating, that signal is zigzagging back and forth. It's bouncing off the narrow walls. That signal going down your waveguide thinks it's in a barbershop with his mirrors on the left side and the right-hand side. If you look into those mirrors at a 45-degree angle, the barber that's down at the end of the hall, you will see him three times in a row because of the multiple reflections. That's what a signal does in waveguide. And in that case, in waveguide, when you build a coupler, it is a co-directional coupler. There's a different mechanism by which the coupling takes place. But when you've got a real semiconductor, it is a counter-directional coupler. Back to you, Howard.
Very good. I understand that now. It's much clearer. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, that's the whole reason why Mel and I put on the show. We think we know a little something, and we're passing on the knowledge. We and the other people who gather, the clan that gathers each Sunday night at the TechNet, tries to convey information to each other. I think we've had enough of these couplers. I think it's time we dip into the mailbag, Mel. K2KEY. K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very always been an interesting subject of methods of measuring. Any type of measurement, there's so much more to it, you know, than meets the eye. You'd be amazed how misunderstood many things that we simply take for granted, you know, simple things like the bird's watt meter, which is mostly very similar to, you know, what we're talking based on what we're talking about. So, basically, building a directional coupler, which I guess we could call it, Dick, a poor man's bird watt meter, over.
Yeah, the slug of a bird watt meter is a small auxiliary line directional coupler. Because that auxiliary line, at almost all the frequencies where you and I use a bird, that little auxiliary line is not a quarter wavelength long. It's much too short. You don't have enough room in there inside the slug to do that. Therefore, the line is much, much shorter than quarter wave. Therefore, it is falling off 6 dB per octave as you go down in frequency. Therefore, a bird's watt meter would naturally have less sensitivity at the low end of its frequency range for that slug, and more sensitivity at the high end. What Bird has done is to take the rectified signal that comes off that directional auxiliary line, directional coupler, put it through a low-pass filter that also rises up at 60 dB per octave. So, by way of the filter action, before you go to the meter movement, they've added a filter that rises at 60 dB per octave, even though the directional coupler itself is picking up a signal that falls off 60 dB per octave as you go down in frequency. One rising 60 dB per octave, one falling 60 dB per octave, the net result is it's essentially flat. That's the good news. The bad news is that most of the slugs are only flat over approximately an octave. You can't keep doing that technique because you start running out of dynamic range of your filtering action. Now you know why each of those slugs has a particular frequency range on it, because you run out of that filter function. K2KEY, K2LIW.
That's very good. Well, that's why something like this directional coupler that you were observing Tom, what was his name? Mullen, yeah, I remember now. Tom McMullen, W1SL, I think it was, when he was putting that together. If you went ahead now, you make two of them identical. You put one way and one the other way. You can simultaneously now take two readings similar to what you would be doing with turning the slugs around, Dick, over.
You've got it. And if you've got enough money, whenever you buy a directional coupler, there doesn't have to be just one coupling line inside the coupler. You could have a straight through line and a piece of strip line going right down the center, left to right, of my piece of strip line in front of me. I can now put an auxiliary line closer to me. I can put a second auxiliary line further than the main center conductor. There's nothing stopping you from putting two, three, and four auxiliary lines in there, and adjust one for the forward coupling and one for reverse coupling. So you can buy dual directional couplers, which is covered in this article in Wireless Design. Is that the name of the Don magazine? Wireless Design and Development, February 2009, on page 10. And just have on your website where you can get to that article, if I know the way these guys operate. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, I know. I purchased a Bird dual plug unit that fits into a tuner. I made a copy. I actually built a tuner to match the F line. Using Collins parts, so Collins rotary inductors, Collins tuning capacitors, the whole business and everything in one of their boxes. I bought a F-line cabinet, and what I added in there to really make it a deluxe tuner of so-called, you know, really make it so to be Collins, so-called Collins quality, was I added a Bird dual slug unit in there, and of course it you just come out with your wiring, right? Basically comes from there and goes to the panel meter, so you have you can have dual reading with those with two slugs, Dick. Very unique good gadget, but somewhat on the costly side. Over.
Yeah, I think I've seen one of those. And what Tom McMullen was doing, W1SL, I think was his call letters. First, to put two of these in that piece of three-quarter inch water pipe with T connectors, water pipe T connectors, and pipe caps and whatever. Very crafty solution to the problem of a poor man's dual Bird watt meter, so to speak, designed for a particular frequency region. Sounds to me like you were tempted to build that at one time. Is that true, Mel?
Oh yeah, I have one. In fact, I built it originally many years ago because I needed something for 2 meters and UHF, and it just seemed to be the ideal gadget to put together because it would, you know, give a very, very accurate reading over a very wide range of frequencies in the VHF and UHF work set. So. And again, like you say, the price is right because you most likely have either most of the materials around, or the most you were going to pay for materials there was maybe about $2 or $3 over.
Yeah, I always get a kick out of the fact that I can go into the plumbing department of Lowe's or Home Depot with my calipers. On some occasions, I was picking up 3/4-inch diameter water pipe to be used as round waveguide at 10 gigahertz. And with my calipers, I'm looking at all the pipes and finding the ones that have low runout, because I didn't want the horizontal wave, because of the ellipticity of the water pipe, to become a vertically polarized wave. And so the guy who runs the department is seeing me measure his pipes with calipers. I could tell by the expression on his face, he was saying, oh no, another one of these crazy engineers that's doing a precision plumbing job in his house. I didn't even bother telling him what I was doing, because it would take too long. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. In fact, I constructed a number of things from Home Depot's plumbing supplies, including a 6-meter beam that I made the elements. Actually had the elements made out of pieces. They had scrap pieces of copper pipe there that they have bins. They sell very cheap, so I used that as a part of the beam. And there's a lot of things you could do, basically, especially get up into the UHF, DHF, or higher with plumbing. So no doubt it's a great source of, I can say, waveguide and all. All right, Dick, yeah, I think we'll just thumbing through here. Get some interesting comments and questions here, over.
Okay, fire when ready.
I have one, too.
Yeah, we haven't heard from you yet, Alex. Go right ahead.
Oh, I was watching WO7. Can't speak too much, but I was wondering if you're going to attack the circulators. Tell me a bit about circulators.
Okay, we coupled, we had a solid hour, so to speak, tonight on directional couplers. At your request, I think we'll consider talking about circulators next week. Will you be available next week to participate in that conversation? Over to you, Alex.
Well, I know very little, but I think I can use them as a directional coupler also. I think that's their meaning in life, but I can't speak too much. Sorry for that.
You're absolutely right. A circulator, properly used, makes a beautiful directional coupler. You could say it becomes a zero decibel directional coupler, is one way of looking at it. And so yeah, they also are kind of magic, but they work by a different process. There it's not Z odd and Z even. It's not the capacitive coupling combined with the transformer coupling, current coupling, magnetic field coupling. It's a different phenomena called gyrotropy. We'll get into that next week. Mel's going to tell us everything about gyrotropy next week. Isn't that true, Mel? Go ahead.
I know I have basically I know I've run across, you know, many of these things, but of course just cruised by them because it wasn't involved in my work at the time. So, basically I guess if I sit and I start to remember and think about it, look up it, all starts to, I say, oh, yes. So, all these things when we start talking about directional couplers, especially, start to come back to me. And if Alex, if you're listening, if you want to go to the ARRL site, as Dick says, you can look back, look at W1SL. I think that was just called Tom. 99%. Well, if you just put in there the keywords directional coupler, you'll be able to get a very good insight on what we're talking about, that how the homebrew one, if you want to, Alex, try to put something together, get an idea, you know, of how it works and get a feel for it, over.
Yeah, okay. I know a little bit about directional couplers in that consecrated embodiment. What I don't know more about is the circulators, and this seems to be an esoteric subject. I haven't read about it enough, but I can't speak too much. There are other people sleeping here, and I don't want to wake them up. Sorry for that.
Okay, Alex. All right. I think we did Yes, I'm sure we did a whole, that time we did, that time we did microwave, a whole discussion on microwave, Dick, because if you remember back, I brought up the subject of microwave. We got into a whole discussion of why we can't take a tube out of a microwave oven and use it for anything in amateur radio, and then we got into a discussion about circulators and making things and using, if you remember, I suggested that we can make a nice waveguide out of a coffee can, and but as long as it was Maxwell House coffee can, right, Dick, over.
Yeah, it's got to be Maxwell House, good to the last drop, because that's the only brand name that follows Maxwell's equations. I know where you're going here. And by the way, the coffee can antenna was a popular 2.4 gigahertz antenna, 2.3 gigahertz antenna, maybe 2.15 gigahertz antenna, roughly 1975, when Home Box Office used to have a New York City service from the Empire State Building, where on that frequency they transmitted their pay-per-view movies. And so a few enthusiastic microwave guys were using coffee can antennas with probes in them to pick up that signal with the right kind of a mixer circuit, put that all in front of a dish or use it directly if you're close enough nearby, and free of charge get those home box office signals. That was all taking place in 1975. In fact, the Muhammad Ali fight, I can't remember who he fought in 1975, was on HBO, and various people were hooking up these coffee cans to be able to watch that fight at home. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh yeah, Roger. I won't get into that, but, oh boy, I guess if you want to be a little unscrupulous, I could have made up quite a few bucks before I got caught. because I did that, Dick. I was there, and I think that's what we discussed, how I put the probe into it and all. And, right, it was very unique that put together that when HBO was transmitting from the Empire State Building. And I remember that quite well. Okay, I guess I can say I won't say no more, because I don't think what we were doing really was legal, because somebody said to me at the time that they can actually sue you for theft of services. I don't know what the law is, if you can just go ahead and pick up any signal, you know, that are being broadcast, if you come up with the, you know, your own homebrew way of doing it, over.
Yeah, I've got a set of opinions on this one, Mel. If you are building circuits and selling them to your friends and neighbors that allow you to free of charge get that service, without a doubt that's theft of service. And you're running a business selling the hardware that does that. However, HBO put that signal into your backyard and you didn't ask for it. And if you, with your own hands, build a chunk of electronics that allows you to sample that signal, and you're not sharing that information with your neighbors, you're not bringing over all the people on Dover Street and bringing them into your living room and charging admission and whatever, you're not doing that. You're just sampling that signal for your own personal purposes, for your own experimental purposes, with hardware you built with your own hands. I am positive that in that situation, it is not theft of service. They put a signal into your yard that you didn't ask for. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I don't know, really, Dick. That's what I heard, that you pick up the signal and even use it for your own, you know, personal use, that because you are not paying for the service, even though it's being, like you say, being sent into my backyard, that they still can claim theft of service. I don't even know what the legal definition of theft of service is, Dick. Does it require that you have to have that you're involving a third party? In other words, like you say, would it be theft of service if I have it in a home and myself with my XYL, my wife is watching it, or with the kids? Would that be the third party involved? I don't know, Dick, over.
Okay. In order to intimidate you, they will definitely tell you that you are committing theft of service. I don't think they could win that case in a court of law. True theft of service would be, let's say that there is a cable television service running down your block across the utility poles. That is somebody else's hardware that you don't own. And now if you tamper with that hardware, cut into that cable and sample that signal, you are definitely creating a violation of somebody else's hardware, and that's clearly theft of service, even though you're doing it for your own personal use. But you are standing on your own piece of property, and the man's home is his castle in the United States to some degree, and you're standing on your own piece of property using nothing of anyone else's, using hardware that you construct with your own hand to take that signal that was put into your yard, and they were foolish enough not to scramble it. Or even if they did scramble it, they scrambled it so lightly that anybody with half a brain can de-scramble it. Such as like inverting the sync pulses, for instance, is one of the scrambling techniques that we used in the very early days. You're not tapping into somebody else's hardware. You're not committing wiretapping. You're doing RF tapping. You own the air over your property, over your house, and you're sampling that signal that they put into your air. I don't think they could win that case, Mel. Go ahead.
And Julio, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dick, the way the law should be, but they changed it. For instance, it's a crime, believe it or not, to listen to cell conversations. I mean, there are no unscrambled cellular conversations anymore, but technically it's a crime to take a scanner and open it up in the 800 megacycle range to listen to cellular. I agree with you where the law should be, but they changed a lot of this during the Reagan administration.
Yeah, without a doubt, you're into a gray zone here, Rich, and I see where you're going. Communication Act of 94, I think, or 96, with reference to cell phones. And they had higher motivation, a lot of cash flow, a lot of privacy issues, and so on. There is no real privacy issue when it comes to over-the-air broadcast of a kind of pay-per-view service that is only lightly encrypted. As I said, they will intimidate the living daylights out of you, but I don't think they could win that case. And they wouldn't, if with half a brain, they wouldn't pursue individual people. Now, if Mel is running a business and selling this to a whole lot of people, yeah, they got strong motivation to go after him. But him as one particular guy who is an experimenter and is not likely to buy the service under normal circumstances, I don't think they're going to pursue him. Nobody in his right mind would pursue poor old Mel. K2KEY, through RAW.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, I guess, well, especially I'm not much of a TV watcher, so the idea is a challenge. And believe me, a number of times I used to sit with the guys at the IEEE meeting in a city at the table lunchtime. That seems to be the main topic. How the heck are they going to, for a better word, take advantage of the cable company with their scrambling and all? How do you get around different things? And that was one of their, favorite subjects, Dick, at the time. All right. Before we get in any trouble here, I think we better go on, over.
I agree. Start reading some emails.
Okay. Last week we discussed, remember when we were talking about antennas, self-antennas, especially like putting them in the attic, and I mentioned the one about tinfoil. Oh boy, did I get tinfoil antennas galore. And in fact, this one guy sent me a whole thing here. He says how to tack the tinfoil up along the ridgepole so that it looked like that it was there by the builder of the house for some reason, using it for some particular purpose, and how he brought it down and everything, and how he put it up using staples, just paper stapling gun. and just it's so thin, it's easy to punch a staple right through it into the wood. And also obtain somebody else here. And how do you get a ground system in the apartment? And boy, this one is really a stealth idea of how to get ground in an apartment. It's very interesting. I thought I'd bring it up for those who are interested in putting stealth systems into rental situations. Over.
I'm interested in the ground.
Yeah, if you've got a really balanced antenna, you may not need the ground. But for an unbalanced antenna, or if you think ground is valuable for reasons of human safety, how do you do it in stealthily manner? And by the way, the stapling of the tinfoil against the ridgepole is a very crafty idea. It can look like the normal insulation that's used, the fiberglass with a tinfoil backing in an attic, and therefore it can become a very innocent-looking thing. And that is pretty crafty. Back to you, Mel.
We've got the attention. He says there are periodic inspections sometimes of, the seated condition up there. Make sure a roof isn't leaking or whatever. But with the tinfoil up there like that, it looks like, I'm sure the previous person inspected it didn't really pay much attention. But if it's done properly, you wouldn't even think twice about it. Okay, here how he did this grounding for his rig. Yeah, very cleverly. He went in the bathroom and he says, looked under the sink, you can see the copper line that comes out, then goes to a valve that's turning off the sink, the water, the cold water, and the hot water in the sink. So he says there's a little fancy chrome plate that goes on the tile, up against the tile as the finishing. And if you move that little plate back, there's usually a space around where the tile, the pipe comes through the tile when they cut the hole to put the pipe through or lay the tile after that. So what he did is he soldered a connection to the copper pipe right there, and he pushed the wire right through the wall using a piece of hanger wire. Was able to just work his way through with points on, in other words, making a very fine drill, and was able to pull a ground wire right through the wall and to his ham, so-called little ham setup next, behind it, in the bedroom behind it. And he says, all I have to do when I have to remove it is just cut it off, push, and put it just a speck of toothpaste, white toothpaste on the wall, and you'd never know it was there, Dick, over.
Does sound pretty crafty. And patching holes in the wall in sheetrock is not that difficult if you've got the skill. So I'm not sure he had to be quite that careful. Back to you, Mel.
Well, case of some circumstances, I can imagine. You could just either pull the wire back and be just a small hole the size of a hanger, but that's what he uses the drill. In other words, a stiff hanger shot into somewhat of a flattened point, and you just keep turning it, and it'll, actually work its way through sheetrock, which is pretty easy to go through. And then you just follow that with the piece of wire tied to the, you use that hanger wire on the end of it with a little tiny, edge of it with the wire hanging on the edge of it, taping it to it or whatever. In other words, then just pulled it through that hole, threaded it through like a needle. And that gave him an excellent ground to the copper line. I don't think you can find anything better. Now, we were talking about using the conduit boxes and things, but I think the cold water pipe, copper cold water pipe, that is soldered all the way down to the source is an excellent way to go, over.
I agree with you. That's about the best ground in the building, other than if the building was made with H-beams and I-beams made out of steel. They might also be a very good ground, but the copper pipe has got to be an excellent ground. And for safety reasons, for human safety of touching your equipment and not getting a shock, that grounding is very valuable. When it comes to balanced RF antennas, like Yagis and dipoles, lots of people think you need a ground to control television interference. I've heard a lot of strong disagreements on that. If it's a truly balanced antenna, the left side of the dipole becomes the counterpoise for the right side, and no real ground is required. A dipole works beautifully in free space, where there's no ground at all. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. You know, I just have that feeling that always that the so-called DC ground, such as cold water pipes and all, is a really a good way to go with amateur radio equipment. It's just a natural way to, you know, provide, like you say, that situation that, you know, it makes it so that there's less of a shock hazard as far as I'm concerned and all. I feel that amateur radio equipment should have a source of ground, a DC ground at least, to stick over.
I live on the first floor and I tried that. That piece of cardboard pipe becomes a terrific antenna. You can't use it more around 10 meters or 15 meters or something like that. Down on 160 years, but not on the upper bands.
You've also got to be a little bit careful. Some of the more modern buildings, somewhere within the potable water system, they sometimes switch over to PVC pipe, in which case that ground may not be ground. But there's ways of confirming that. All modern-day buildings have a 110-volt plug, which is a free wire plug. And so that third round pin, the so-called safety, is supposed to be grounded to earth. And so when in doubt, you in theory could first put your voltmeter and then your ohmmeter between that round pin and your water pipe and confirm that your water pipe is good ground. And by various techniques, you can find out which one is the better ground. Now back to you, Mel.
Yes, you could use both, no problem. Connect the two of them together. Here in Brooklyn, New York, I guess the five boroughs, you have to use copper water pipe or brass water pipe. You cannot put PVC. They do not allow you to put a PVC pipe in there. And so I would assume that all the copper pipes that you're going to find here in any construction, whether it's the old or new and all, or brass plumbing or whatever it is, it's going to be straight through. But like you say, you can easily confirm it by checking from supposedly that third lead, the ground lead that's on the on your receptacle there, is going to a positive ground downstairs. I think that's a law, Dick, that it must be, like you say, definitely grounded down the basement there at the point where the electric comes in. And I think they're fairly strict about that, over.
And so do I. I think that they're quite strict and should be as part of the code, the building code. Also, burn into your mind that if anyone ever wants to replace the valve that comes from the street that brings you water into your building, and if that valve becomes leaky and they want to replace it, and you watch the guy doing that replacement or talk to him ahead of time before he does that repair job for you, make sure he knows what danger there is at the instant he opens up those two pieces of copper pipe. That in the worst case scenario, there could be 2300 or 7800 volts appearing across those two water pipes, because in some cases, the pole peg transformer giving you 220, 110 power into your house, that it is a auto transformer, and the grounding of that transformer is supposed to take place by the butt plate and the piece of 6-gauge wire that goes down the utility pole. But if that utility pole has been replaced a few times, or if some mischievous person in your neighborhood decides to steal that copper wire and sell it for scrap, and that grounding isn't there, then the only grounding left for that transformer is the grounding of your fuse box in your house. And I've known of many cases of where something goes wrong with the grounding in the house, and all of a sudden 7,800 volts appears on that fuse box. It can burn down the house, it can electrocute a person who's got one hand on each one of those pieces of pipe as he's separating it. A smart electrician will put a very large clamp, in other words, a jumper cable that you would use on an automobile. He puts it across those two pieces of pipe before separating it, and make sure that he's doing it with a thick set of rubber gloves besides, because dangerous. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, in the way the copper prices of copper were, they were stealing left and right. A lot of construction sites around here, they had to have a watchman, basically, just to make sure they didn't steal the copper pipe or the wiring. It was terrible here. They were stealing right out of the street, pulling out lengths of it. The lights would go out from areas. There would be no lights on the street because they stripped out the length of copper wire. The worst place was along a couple of parkways here in Brooklyn. Went completely dark because the copper wire was stolen. So good point you brought up there, Dick, that really could be a death trap. Or like you say, burn the house down or whatever. I wonder how many of those violations are out there. It'd be hard to even imagine that. Yeah, I've heard every year during the winter time, when the salt is laid on the streets and on the sidewalks, how many people have gotten shocked by walking by some of those Con Edison submerged transformers. Over.
Let me reiterate that the building ground in a common household is good for 60 hertz and DC. As you increase the frequency of your transmitter or usage, that ground becomes more and more reactive and starts to become an antenna. So I will not recommend a ground longer than 5 foot or something like that. The people like me living on the first floor are really doomed, or they have to use symmetrical antennas. Dick?
Yeah, I think the easiest way around the problem is to try to use symmetric antennas, balanced antennas, wherever possible. Unbalanced antennas, like a quarter-wave ground plane in the backyard, can be troublesome if you don't have a whole lot of counterpoise, wires, the ground radials laid down, a whole lot of them. It's much easier to make it half wave instead of a quarter wave. It automatically becomes balanced. And a half wave vertical is an extremely effective antenna, whether you feed it at one end or the center. That's your choice. It's an extremely unpopular antenna because people don't believe what it can do. They think a dipole has always got to be parallel to the ground. A half-wave dipole, if you've got a high enough structure that can hold it up, even a tree or a flagpole or a tower, can be very effective. Over to you, Bill.
This is K2KEY. In fact, I got one here on it. A couple of them here on dipoles. If you have to bend the dipole, here's one. If I have to bend the ends of the dipole, is it better to bend them up, down, or sideways? I wonder, does it really make a difference? How much difference does it make, Dick, the way you bend the ends of the dipole? Whether you have to bend it, what would be your preference? Over.
As far as the resonance of the dipole is concerned, except for bending down and the tip coming close to the ground and adding some extra capacitance, except for that effect, it does not matter. As far as the dipole, Q, bandwidth, and resonance is concerned. There is a little bit of difference of left and right versus up and down as far as the antenna pattern. It's a small difference, but there's a difference. A pure, flat-out, parallel-to-the-ground dipole has a pretty deep null in its radiation collinear with the wire. Off the ends in that direction, there's a pretty deep null. As you curve that wire left, right, or up or down, left and right, you're creating some horizontal polarization off the end. Up and down, you're creating some vertical polarization off the ends. So you're making a modification to the pattern, and the greatest modification is in the directions where there normally would be a null. So in theory, a person could say, gee, that null is off the end because of the layout of my particular property. It's in the direction of London, and I really like to talk to people in London. And these people in London, by some means, you could find out that they're more likely to hear a vertical polarization than a horizontal. In that case, I would curve it up and down rather than left and right. Now, that's a slightly fictitious story I just said, because the way the ionosphere twists the polarization of the signal, and it's called Faraday rotation, even though I launch a vertical signal here in New York. When it gets to London, it probably goes through about five twists, and it might end up there today, horizontally polarized. So because of that degree of non-predictability, I'm not sure which way would work better. When in doubt, run the experiment. K2KEY, K2LAW. Doesn't cost much.
Yeah, Roger. That's a good question. Which way? I don't know if it makes much of a difference, really, Dick. It's Mother Nature puts the, bends the signal, twists the signal, and also, you know, what you look like many times, like, oh boy, I'm pointing right in the right direction. All of a sudden, you wind up talking to somebody in South Africa or whatever. It's quite amazing. And it just happened, thankfully. We had some decent conditions this week, and I meant to mention we had the ARRL had their CW contest, and I was amazed to see how much CW is alive and well, because the bands were just packed with stations from end to end on CW, and I had a little bit of fun working a number of the stations. I'm just looking for something else here while I'm going through it here, Dick, over.
If I may. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I'm trying to be short here. Horizontal dipole, if you bend it ends vertically up, you're changing the current distribution on it, especially on receive. So you will have some phase distortion between left arm or right hand arm that can be destructive or constructive. So yeah, you have to take that in account. That changes the whole pattern of the antenna. There's much more to say, but I can't. Sorry for that. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Alex, I think you're being a little bit severe. You called it a phase distortion. Antennas can be zigzagged in all kinds of crazy ways, and I wouldn't call it distortion. You are changing the pattern, but at first the pattern changes slowly. If you study what's going on with many of the modeling programs like NEC and MiniNEC, they are adding up little increments of current along the wire. You've got the maximum current in the center of the dipole, so from the method of analysis used by these modeling programs, you could say the center of the dipole does more of the radiating. The tips of the dipole are there in order to give you resonance and lower the Q. But the real radiation is taking place in the center. If that's true, and I'm not sure about this one, but it's the way the modeling programs work, at first, as you zigzag the ends, you're doing a very minor perturbation to the resultant pattern. And whatever you do to the pattern, because of the law of reciprocity, it's going to have the same effect on transmit and receive. You can't change the pattern in one without changing the other. So I wouldn't call it a distortion. I would call it a minor change in the pattern. And because of where the current is, I think it's a rather slow change in the pattern at first. And the pattern change is not necessarily undesirable. I mean, the torus donut-like pattern we get out of a flat-out dipole isn't necessarily the best pattern. It's one that's classic and we know about. But if I get a slightly bumpier pattern, that's not necessarily bad. That's a set of opinions. K2LIW.
Well, I agree with you, Dick. I'll tell you why. I had a reference dipole I had up there. I was making measurements against the loop, the vertical and all that, my reference dipole. And I started thinking, you know, I had the dipole really flop and loose. You could honestly say it looked more like the legs of it were more like going up and down and looking force and everything like that. It looked like a big W if you looked at it sideways. There was, you know, a lot of places up and down because I tried to take the strain off it because the objects move and all, and I know if it gets into an argument, the dipole with the tree where the sports were on a number of trees, that you know, the dipole surely is going to lose the battle with the tree. So I then said to myself, what happens if I do pull them nice and tight, you know, make them classic straight dipole like you would, you know, I can look like in a book. does it have any effect? And I did that, and I tried it, you know, with a number of checks I made with my friends and everything like that. Is that making any difference? Do you notice any difference in my signal over a few nights and all? And nothing, Dick. Nobody ever said that, oh, your signal is better or anything. Nothing detectable, over.
That doesn't surprise me. I'm relatively sure the pattern is going to change very slowly at first. And as you change the pattern with zigzagging more and more enthusiastically, eventually you're making a vertically polarized dipole, which is an extremely high-performance antenna. Don't fight it. It's an antenna that we have not given anywhere near its fair share of testing. And we should. Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KEY, and that's what I'm reading here about. Another question about dipole. Let's see. An inductively loaded dipole. I'm interested in, again, see, I'm picking up on a lot of these situations here, the urban situations, where people here have to compromise on their antennas, especially on HF right now. The reliability now of HF radio at night is basically 40 meters, 80 meters, 160 and all, and this is, presents a problem to, you know, string these antennas, a half-wave antennas even at these frequencies. So everybody is really considering, you know, alternate antennas that they sell. And here, a consideration here, I'm interested in foreshortened, inductively loaded short antenna. However, what happens, where do you put the coils really, and what happens to the sensor impedance? For instance, if I go to a quarter wavelength at the full length instead of a half wavelength by adding the, making up the difference with inductors, Dick, what comes, I know the feed peak, the drive peak is going to be different over.
It sure is. And there's a couple of curves in the basic antenna book by ARRL. I think there's a similar set of curves in the antenna handbook. There's a beautiful set of curves by Brown and Woodward, done in 1946, and in every issue of Antenna Engineering Handbook, chapter number 4, on the second, third, and fourth edition, the Brown and Woodward curve will show you for every reasonable diameter of dipole or monopole, of every reasonable length, those two sets of curves by Brown and Woodward are going to tell you with very high accuracy exactly what resistor value you get of the impedance and what reactive value. It's all documented. So the Brown and Woodward curves give you a beautiful answer. Now I'm going to give you a synopsis. As you make the physical dimension of a half-wave dipole, which starts off at 72 ohm resistance and no reactance, as you make the physical length of the dipole shorter and shorter, the 72 ohms goes toward zero. The resistive component gets lower and lower as you make the dipole shorter and shorter. Now, when you make the dipole shorter, physically shorter, you can reestablish electronic resonance by putting loading coils at the bottom, in the center of the dipole, or the bottom of the quarter wave monopole, top hat capacitors at the top, zigzagging it and whatever. Let me drop. There's been a whole series of articles over the years of guys will say, yeah, if I put the loading coil at the bottom, I've got a very little area of high current at the bottom, then the loading coil makes the current beyond that point lower. So they start moving the loading coil higher and higher on the monopole, or further and further out from the center of the dipole. They put the loading coils. Their philosophy is that there's a longer and longer length of wire that has high current on it, and they do that. And so they're convinced that the antenna has higher performance if they move the loading coil further away from center. Good common sense. Almost untrue. It's one of these self-fulfilling prophecies where somebody believes that, he does that experiment, and he thinks he sees an improvement. What Chu and Wheeler did, these two guys in roughly 1946, around the same time as Brown and Woodward, they made a whole series of experiments of dipole-like structures of various length. And the conclusion they came to is no matter how you lay it out, the main thing that counts is the volume of the antenna. The physical volume of the antenna, as you shrink it down, the Q will go up in a predictable manner. As the Q goes up, the bandwidth goes small. The impedance matching becomes more difficult. The resistive component gets smaller, and if you didn't hit resonance, the reactive component gets pretty fierce real fast as you QSY. In other words, your antenna tuner is going to have to work a lot harder when you QSY if you've made the antenna physically shorter, smaller. Physically smaller, higher Q. That's the universal law. How you distribute it is not as much of a difference as you think. As long as you're using lossless materials that don't have a lot of resistance, any way you can establish resonance and any way you can get an impedance match to it with a reasonably low loss transmission line, and if that transmission line doesn't have to operate with a fierce high standing wave ratio, which gives you extra loss of the line, as long as you fulfill those criteria, you'll work like a charm. Let me drop one more time. And the magic of all this that really defies common sense is that as your physical dipole starts off a half wavelength long and you make it smaller and smaller so it becomes what Krauss would call the infinitesimal length dipole, common sense would lead you to believe that the effective area has to go to zero and the antenna becomes less and less effective. Good common sense. Dead wrong. I'll admit that as the antenna becomes smaller and smaller, the Q becomes higher and higher. That means the bandwidth becomes more and more narrow, and the energy on the antenna is going to bounce back and forth a higher number of times before it finally gets radiated. And the definition of resonance is all of those bounces have to stay in step, co-phase. That's what resonance is. And when you finally establish that resonance of a higher number of bounces, when you QSY a little bit, obviously all of those bounces fall out of step a lot faster if there's more of them. That's a left-handed way of saying it's more narrowband and the Q is higher. But as you go to the infinitesimal dipole and you assume your effective area is going to go to zero and your gain is going to go to zero, doesn't happen. You lose 0.4 dB of gain. That's it. You lose 0.4 dB of gain when you go from a full half-wave dipole all the way down to an infinitesimal dipole. At the resonant frequency, you've only lost 0.4, and it's not a resistive loss. It's a minor change in the pattern. The donut becomes a little bit fatter. That's it. And you're about to think, okay, if the infinitesimal dipole only loses 0.4 dB of gain, it must have almost the same area. And the answer is yes. And you're about to say, where the hell is the area coming from if I don't see it? That's the magic of resonance. That's the magic of a high Q structure. When that signal is bouncing back and forth a zillion times on that infinitesimal dipole, and you've re-resonated it with low-loss materials, all of that stored energy creates a great big field around that antenna. Doesn't matter if you're transmitting or receiving. It creates a big, great big field. And you've got 95% of the original area. Your eye doesn't see it. The radio wave at the resonant
repeater. Time out.
The radio wave at the resonant frequency, it sees that area. You may not like the fact the antenna becomes narrowband as all hell, and you got to keep readjusting all the controls every time you QSY. But don't be afraid about making the antenna smaller. Don't do it if you don't have to. But if you're forced by the physical constraints of your particular living arrangement, where you've got to make a physically small antenna with loading coils and zigzags and top hats, go to it, and you think because it's 1/10 the size, you're going to have 1/10 the performance. You're going to get 95% of the performance at the resonant frequency as you would if it's full out. That's the good news. And because it's so opposite of common sense, Mel and I keep repeating this about once every month. And people say, what the heck are these guys smoking? Where the heck is this coming from? I can show you chapter and verse in very respected journals, Antenna Engineering Handbook.